Merry Christmas, Squawker Talker listeners. You're listening to today's holiday special, the best way to spend your Christmas morning, Christmas Eve, whenever you're going to listen. Grab everyone around the fire and put on the Squawker Talker. And joining me to do so in this festive period is Chief Writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays to you and to everyone and to everyone and you. Or something.
And also joining us, wishing, I'm sure, happy holidays to everyone in the world.
I would hope
is
so.
Is Thomas Rooney, content extraordinaire.
How's it going? You all right? Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah, good to be here. It's great to have you both on in what will be a review of 2018 in general. The calendar year, the stat that people hate to look at. We'll be looking at Real Madrid's record breakers, France's World Cup champions, the heroes, the villains of the year. And we're also going to be having a very special guest in the second half of the podcast. But I've got special guests already, so we're going to talk about first question, which is, we're going in strong as well. Who has been the best or what has been the most memorable team in Europe this year?
Well, I mean,
we'll start with you, Mo.
The best team is Man City, I think. You have to, looking at the whole year, the football they've played, but they're not really memorable. They're obviously the brilliant and the best team or whatever, but the most memorable team, we have to be France, doesn't it? The World Cup winners, and not just because they were World Cup winners, but because they did it in such style, not necessarily playing good football, but
I was going to say,
in terms of the attitude, a young, diverse squad. Lots of ethnic backgrounds, lots of unity there in the wider world, which is full of disharmony.
2018 in general, I think, is
a few
people's least favorite year. Yeah, but football-wise,
not a great year. But you know, so it was nice to see a France side like that win the World Cup. They played, you know what, cohesively and with a clear unity and a clear vision. They wasn't necessarily the most attractive team in the world to watch, but they knew what they were doing. They were well organized. They played some very exciting games as well, where their defense failed them against Argentina, but they won a shootout anyway. Against Uruguay, it was very much defense. Against Belgium, it was very much again defense. And in the World Cup, they won a shootout, so the final. So you know, they were fun to watch. Lots of great, lovely players. I mean, who doesn't love Golo Kanté? What a man! Great song about him too. Benjamin Mendy, fantastic, good fun. Paul Pogba had a good time in 2018 for 2 months. You know, good for him. About the end time in the whole year, he's actually managed to smile.
Kante's anthem. Should be Christmas number
that
one.
It
should be Christmas number one. Make it so, Squawker listeners.
Thomas, what about you? Do you agree with France being the most memorable?
I do to an extent, because obviously it was such a fantastic World Cup and one of the best I can remember in terms of just had everything, certainly in the early
VAR
stages.
VAR made its appearance.
So I'd say France were incredible. I don't think I'll remember their run to the final and semi-final like forever, but in terms of individual performances, Mbappe, Pogba, Griezmann were at certain times very, very good. Team-wise, though, as Mo says, I mean, I think Manchester City are the best team in 2018 across the leagues, complete dominance, record breakers. Like we've mentioned before, so many good young players. Pep's philosophy coming across here, and you know he's got the team playing sort of incredibly good football. So I'd say France, you know, very, very memorable, but Man City the best team. And just a hat tip, even though Real Madrid weren't great going to the Champions League final, the fact that was Ronaldo's last sort of heyday for Real Madrid.
Zidane signing off in style.
Exactly. I think that I will remember that in terms of the scenes with Zidane and Ronaldo at the end.
But Man City, they're not even top of the league now.
They will be in May, though.
And they got beaten by Liverpool.
Well,
so is Klopp's team
Klopp's memorable? Team, I would put Klopp's team in the next category, which is, I'm sure you'll bring us to.
Yeah.
I think Liverpool were very, very good in 2018. They've run to the Champions League final, destroyed Roma and Man City on the way to the semi-final, on the final. So
No proof in the pudding as of yet.
No proof in the pudding. And also just City's consistent. Even this season, I know Liverpool technically are top and they've been objectively more consistent than City. They've got more points. But you look at City and the football they've played.
In 2018, Man City have won 46 games, which is 10 more than any other side.
I mean, there we go.
So there you go. I've finished that.
They're sensational to watch.
They've created the most chances in the Premier League in 2018. And also have the most touches in the opposition box. So In terms of attacking talent and what we see, we saw the culmination of Pep Guardiola's style being realised, I think, especially in that latter half. Yeah. The 100-point season, which was the first in top-flight history.
Yeah, and the way they got the 100 points as well was a last-minute goal, wasn't it?
The Aguero moment. The title was already sealed, but to break a record with that last-minute winner, Gabriel Jesus, that moment in itself, whipping off his shirt and celebrating that, is a memorable moment. For me as well, I think the best team were Man City, and they're most memorable. I think you have to go with that World Cup, with Kylian Mbappe sort of announcing himself on that world stage, tearing up Argentina. Yeah. As you said, great individual performances throughout. Rafael Varane being a colossus at the back.
Varane and Umtiti were an incredible partnership. Like, yeah, and also, if you watch Lloris for Spurs, you think, this guy won the World Cup. What? It's like, it's mad.
Well, I think Lloris, even in that tournament, had the glimpses of class and
it's just funny that he won the, but no, Varane and Titi, shout out to those two guys, because that was an incredible,
as a memorable team. And then you look what happened to some of them afterwards. They've all maybe some of them have suffered at club level. Have you mentioned Pogba?
Literally Mbappe and Griezmann are the only two that haven't like had a huge fall off. I mean, Titi's injury based, not, he was playing well before he got injured, but everyone else, like, oh, wow, not good.
I think, yeah. And given the squad that France had taken into that World Cup, the players that they left at home, Martial, Lacazette, Benzema's not been involved in ages, Koscielny was
injured. We've got an article about their depth and how ridiculous
exactly. So to say that they won it, it wasn't a surprise. Mm. But 20 years after Deschamps won it as captain, lifted it as manager.
Playing the same system, I might add. The exact same system. If you look at
it ain't broke.
If you look at the 2018 side, the structure of it is almost identical to 1998. Mbappe, the difference is being Mbappe versus Zidane, Mbappe's more of a striker, and Pogba versus Kadamba. Pogba is more of a creator than Kadamba. So he sort of split the Zidane role over two of them. But it's a very identical system, very fun team. They could have won it better with Dembele, but they won it nevertheless.
Yeah. But that is your... the one actual grind for the whole of 2017. Yes. That is a sharply grinded axe, I think.
Yes.
But as I said, they weren't a surprise to win it, because the talent pool that France team has at its disposal is scary and probably makes them favourite for the next two major tournaments.
Yeah.
And we touched on it just there, and we said Liverpool run to the final, Klopp's team top of the league, 19 points clear of rivals Man United, everything's going right. Van Dijk's arrived, Alisson's arrived. In terms of a biggest surprise package in this calendar year, well, January to December, are Liverpool top of that for you? Thomas,
not,
we'll start with
they
you.
Are not, actually. It's got to be England for me. I just think, in terms of memorably as well, we're talking about that, it's just got to be England. It's something I'll tell my grandkids about this summer. The fact that nobody saw it coming as well, because, I mean, the biggest surprise, like a year ago, if you say England were going to sort of unite the nation, which is particularly difficult at the moment, and get to the World Cup semi-final and have all these sort of memorable moments, the penalty shootout victory. I mean, we've never won a World Cup penalty shootout before.
We have now.
Trippier's free kick, when I just thought everything, I thought we'd won it at that point. And I just think,
I just think
in terms of surprise for England, the England football team to galvanise a nation after the Euro 2016, when it was just beyond bad, and World Cup 2014, very bad. That is a huge surprise. Maybe not when the squad was announced, and then in the warm-up games, you maybe start to think there was something that could happen. But, you know, rewind a year or two, nobody would have thought that would happen. And I think, you know, it's got all the package. It's a surprise, and it's incredibly memorable. And
it resonates with us Englishmen, I think.
It does.
But I mean, in terms of a football lens, was it not more surprising to see Croatia that beat England?
Over to me.
Get to the final.
See, that was my answer, because Croatia, although now I want to change it to England, hearing you guys talk about it, I'm like, oh my God. Because I just remembered just to speak on England briefly, it's December and my son is still singing Three Lines. Like, so the impact that England had on young football lovers around this country is immeasurable.
Well, I think people fell back in love.
I mean,
national team at least.
Adults did, but you can't imagine what the impact this is having on young players who love the game, because it's like to watch your country do well, really well, play well, get far in a World Cup and have fun. I mean, you talk about France having a good squad, England young, diverse squad, full of people, immigrants or children of immigrants, you know, descendants of immigrants. Fantastic in this age of Brexit. That was fantastic to see. England were so unified. Southgate, lovely. But, you know, anyway, my answer
waistcoats.
Waistcoats.
In terms of fashion statement of 2018,
waistcoats.
Gareth has got that one locked down.
Yeah. But look,
considering you could buy Christmas jumpers, I mean, that were in the shape of that waistcoat, which I hope some listeners have purchased or been purchased.
It was funny because obviously there's that Nike ad about Londoners and Gareth Southgate was playing God in the advert and it was just like, that's a bit much, isn't it? But look at the record, we're like, no, that's absolutely correct.
They got it spot on.
And just one more shout out about England is that the announcement video for the squad, I remember when that came out where they had all the people from the different parts of the country announcing players from, and I just, that was lovely touching. England just, England are wonderful.
Yeah, England did well in the summer.
Croatia, tiny, tiny country. You could fit the whole thing in England multiple times over, you know, and tiny population, young country, and they went to the World Cup final and they were arguably the better team in the final for the last majority of it. They were phenomenally resolute. Luka Modric and Ivan Rakitic were just Herculean, and Brozovic, let's be fair.
Yeah, I was going to say, Brozovic.
Herculean in their efforts to get that team there because Perisic, Rebic and Mandzukic were all very good in spurts, but in spurts those the three midfielders were phenomenal the whole tournament. They protected a defence that had Domagoj Vida in it, which should not have been as solid
as
it was. Well, yeah, best defender in the world, Dejan Lovren, of course.
Well, 2018 was the year of the Lovren, I think.
Their left back, Croatia's left back, I can't remember his name now, was consistently terrible.
Strinic,
for the, yeah, the entire tournament was awful and never really got exposed. Well, except by Mbappe in the final, but you know, Croatia were phenomenal. Their organisation was great. They tried to play as good football as they could. They had limitations, but they tried. They were brilliant against Argentina in the group stage, which isn't hard. Argentina were terrible, but they slapped them aside with great verve. They got out of the group very good. Two penalty shootout wins. Two consecutive penalty shootout wins. That's physically just ridiculous. No team should be able to manage that. And they did. Rakitic scoring two consecutive winners, first person ever to do that in the tournament. Modric just getting better in extra times, which, again,
missing one penalty.
Missing penalty, but I mean, performance wise, got better in extra times.
The fact that he had that sort of refueling station locked away somewhere.
And that was so, I think that was huge as well. The fact that he could then get better while everyone else was getting tired, he just sort of improved because that sort of gave them the belief they could do it. And they went to a third extra time with England, let's not forget. It didn't go to the shootout because they won it, but it went in semi final, went to extra time as well.
I think that's one of the main reasons Modric picked up that player of the tournament was the fact that he was able to, maybe he wasn't the best in 90 minutes, but in those decisive extra
the
half
last
an hour
30
periods,
minutes, he came to play.
He looked bigger than everyone on
he
the pitch.
He came to play, and it was notable. It was notable he came to play. Although, ironically, I did think a lot of the hype around before the final was around Modric and Kante as players of the tournament. I thought, a funny thing is, I thought both of them are very poor in the final. Like they'd left it all out getting their teams there.
Well, that's what I mean. They did all their work, and then they just handed it over to
Pogba, Rakitic. They wanted to step up in the final itself, and Brozovic again. Shout out Brozovic.
Yeah, well, Brozovic as well has invented. Well, I don't know if he invented it, but he's made the crocodile famous when he laid down behind the free kick against Barcelona, which had Messi laughing in the stands.
That was very, very good.
Again, I don't know what the year of the crocodile isn't in the Chinese.
I like
calendar, is it? But Brozovic has made it the year of the crocodile anyway. Which
I like Brozovic. I like he had a very again. It was funny because obviously Modric like soaked up all the hype, like Superman does the rays of the sun. But Rakitic and Brozovic were really important, and without them he couldn't have done that.
That World Cup threw up some surprises anyway. One VAR was good.
VAR was
used.
Phenomenal.
And now everyone's wanting it to be. But Russia as well. Mm-hmm. Say what you will about everything behind closed doors or whatever. I don't want to get into that.
Yeah,
on the
not.
Pitch.
Yeah.
On the pitch.
Very, very good.
They were surprising. And they were good hosts on the pitch, as I said. That surprised me. Liverpool, I think,
deserve it. They definitely deserve a mention, yeah.
Maybe it's not surprising seeing Klopp's style of play being so successful in tournament football, but to get there in the way that they did, with the front three becoming the first trio to score 10 goals each in the Champions League.
In December 2017, or January, technically January 2018, they sold their best player, right? Coutinho. They should not have gotten better after selling their best player, and they did. That is a surprise. That is a surprise. Like he was clearly their best player when he left. They just thought, okay, fine, and they got better. As a team, they're better now. And it's like, and shout out to Mohamed Salah. Sat to Sadio Mane, Roberto Firmino.
I think Salah himself could be seen as a surprise package because again, most goals in 2018 consistent in the Premier
finishing.
League. First player ever to score 32 goals in a 38-game season. Yeah. No one expected that from a signing that had previously been in the Premier League as well. He wasn't an unknown quantity. People knew he was good, but they didn't know that he was going to be an extraterrestrial goal scorer.
Yeah, is this the funny thing? If you follow me for a long time, you know that I've been a big fan of Salah for ages, but I've always said he's not a consistent finisher. His movement is elite. His timing is actually world-class, but when he gets in front of goal, he fluffs his lines. So often it happens. I mean, talking about Real Madrid, he could have knocked Real Madrid out of the Champions League back in 2016. He could have ended the Zidane dynasty before it even began, but he missed like two or three really, really, really good chances at the Bernabeu. But then...
But now he's in a team under where Klopp, he gets 20 chances a game.
Under Klopp.
Because it's funneled towards him. Yeah. And...
But Roberto Firmino's fantastic, Sadio Mane's fantastic. Credit to Jurgen Klopp, because he has turned Mohamed Salah into literally one of the best forwards in the world. So
That's a pretty nice little line to go on. We mentioned Luka Modric, and 2018 was the year that another famous dynasty, or duopoly, if you will,
was
ended. And that is obviously Messi and Ronaldo, none of them picking up the Ballon d'Or. Messi wasn't even on the podium. And at the start of... If you go back to January and you said, if you even just said Messi and Ronaldo won't win the Ballon d'Or, you would have been told you were silly. But for Messi to finish fifth, obviously with the World Cup going on, that had huge sway. Griezmann, as we said, had a sort of silently brilliant...
It was so strange.
2018. Let's just go with the one question. Modric won the Ballon d'Or. He actually swept up every individual award and became the first person ever to do so.
Yeah.
So the World Cup, that Croatia story, as we said, perhaps that is biggest surprise package ties into it.
Mm.
But was it deserved? Did we see it? We didn't see it coming. We know we didn't see it coming.
It's a difficult one, because if the Ballon d'Or is the best player in that year, then he's not the best player in the whole year. But it's accumulation of, you know, he's been fantastic for Real Madrid for a number of years. He was, like you said, instrumental for Croatia as they got to the final of the World Cup. He was the player of the tournament. He won the Champions League again with Real Madrid. So I think if Ronaldo maybe stayed at Real Madrid, he probably would have won it. I don't know. But
we know what that implies.
I just think he's an obviously incredible player. He's actually probably dipped off after the World Cup this season.
Oh, he's fallen off a cliff,
But then it probably was, you know, got to the point where, you know, he's won everything, so he's going to win this as well, because, you know, it's been an accumulation of... You know, he's an incredibly good player, but this is sort of the moment of his career that he's been waiting for.
And I think something that's always sort of said is that individual awards in a team sport will never really make sense, because it's in a team. So maybe the weight of the teams that Modric played in performed so brilliantly and he was a key part of that, you could make that argument that he deserved it in that case. Because yes, Lionel Messi is the best player. He's leading scoring and assist charts again this season. His 2018, he scored 50 goals 8 out of 9 years. He's obviously the best objectively good footballer in the world, even though he may not be from this world itself. But Modric was part of a team that no one expected to get to the final and was a key part of it. As we said, unbelievable efforts when it seemed everyone else would be faltering to get the Croatia team there. Part of the Real Madrid that won the Champions League, made history. Yes, they haven't been great this season, but in terms of team feats... He was the key individual. Maybe Ballon d'Or need to tweak their sort of criteria.
It's how you define it, doesn't it?
I think to me, what the Modric win was, you can say deserved or not. Like, it's because obviously, like you guys have said it, basically, he's not the best player in the world. So if it's for the best player in the world, then he shouldn't win it. But if it's for a sort of representation of the best team, then yeah, then he should win it. And it also, he said in his speech, I think he said this is for people, the players like Xavi, Iniesta, and that who should have won it but didn't, like Schneider as well. And I think you look at players like that, like Xavi, Iniesta, Schneider, Melito in 2010 had a very good chart, very good case for it, but they didn't win it. Ribery in 2013 had a brilliant case. I don't know how he didn't win that thing. You know, it was, and you look at players like that. Pepe was the biggest, got completely screwed over 2016 when he was phenomenal for Madrid winning the Champions League and Portugal winning the Euros. More important to both sides than Cristiano Ronaldo. Didn't win the Ballon d'Or in the end. You know, so there have always been players where you think, yeah, they deserve it in the logic of, because it's obviously not for the best player in the world. It never has been, because if it would, it would just go to one or two players like every few seasons.
It had been doing that, to be honest. It had been going to them. It had been going to two players, and there were definitely years where Ronaldo was blowing everyone else out.
But it was nice for Modric to win it. It's one of those things where you think, yeah, should he have won it? Well, he's not the best player in the world, but at the same time,
that's what I mean. They just changed it to say this, I think what you've said there is nailed on.
Yeah,
this award goes to the best player. This goes to the player who best represents one of the best teams in the world. And Modric was at the heart of that Real Madrid team.
Exactly. The key midfielder for Real Madrid, the one that made their midfield work, because Casemiro and Kroos are both brilliant at certain their things, roles, but limited. Yeah. They're essentially brilliant role players, which sounds really weird to say, but it's true. Modric is the guy that made it all tick in midfield. And for Croatia, again, he was the superstar, whereas Rakitic and Brozovic helped him get there, and they were just as important. He was the guy, the talisman of the side. And even Rakitic has said it, like it was an honour to play with him. He was the, you know, he's our captain. We have to follow him into, you know, follow him to hell or whatever it is, you know. So he was, it's that sort of thing where it's like, deserve? Well, yeah. Like, if, you know, it's hard to, you would never say that he didn't deserve it. Do you know what I mean? It's one of those things. More so that he did. It's like, you could never say, yeah, he shouldn't have won
it's
that.
It's just the small print needs editing, I think.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the thing. Actually, when you look at it, the Ballon d'Or, that it's not called World Player of the Year. No. It's called the Ballon d'Or. Yeah. So it could be for, people have assumed.
It's just a gold ball.
People have conferred on it the best player in the world. It doesn't necessarily have to be for that. And I think, again, like for Modric, I would never say he didn't deserve it. Do you know what I mean? Whether I would say who did, I would say Modric. You know, you have to be happy for Modric.
Yeah,
great footballer, wonderful, elegant player.
And considering the heat he got when he first joined Real Madrid, that around is
and
quite
it was.
Nice.
I mean, and you know what? Again, I don't say this very often, but credit to Jose Mourinho for signing Luka Modric. I don't say, you know, I don't give but he did that, and everyone's like, "What are you doing?
We're just getting past Christmas, and that's the first bit of praise this year that
the second bit of praise. I did say he improved Jesse Lingard.
Mark that with the second 2018. Bit of praise. To be a complete devil's advocate, even though I brought up that thing, you would argue that if it was a player that best represented the best teams,
or Mbappe,
Griezmann or Varane.
Or Varane or Mbappe. Well, I think Varane's course was really hurt by the fact that, one, he's a defender, and two, he's been shockingly bad.
And what we're saying is the two teams that we just picked out, the memorable best teams across Europe in 2018, and we said, well, no Man City players getting a mention, maybe is because of Champions League, and none of them performed particularly well in the World Cup. So they're ruled out because they only did at one-on-one level.
Yeah.
So the teams that won the Champions League, Europe's elite competition, and won the World Cup, the elite competition, a main feature of both of those sides, Rafa who Varane. Was a colossus in both of them, was Varane. And I thought this was the year where he had a chance to revert back. If you look at what happened in 2006 with Cannavaro, Varane's path sort of he had a better claim than that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's just the sense that, yes, Modric, for this tiny little nation, was the motor force.
Plus,
to get
it was
them
also,
into a
it's
final.
Also the fact the Varane style of defending is counts against him. He's like, he's so steady and just so, like, not, you don't even notice him doing it. Like, it's funny because for Real Madrid and thingy,
he's the opposite of Ramos, isn't he?
Yeah, he's
outspoken, like, goal-scoring.
For France, the guy who does that, who's the more Ramos kind of all-action defender, is Umtiti, right? So if Umtiti had won the Champions League and the World Cup, maybe he would have had a chance.
And his Umtiti's dance.
Yes, well, the dance celebration.
During the World Cup celebration.
Varane is just such a sort of quiet, sort of unassuming, just gets on with his job, the commanding leader, you know, the
silent leader.
Yeah, that's the thing. So that counts against him as well, because he's a defender, one. And two, he's so unassuming in his brilliant defending that it's just like, he did. You almost forget that he did those things, even though he did. And Griezmann, I think Griezmann is probably the big one, though. I think if you look at, he's 28 now, 29, 27. He's had a phenomenal career. He was absolutely essential for Atletico Madrid winning the Europa League. Scored a goal in the final for the first time ever. Took France to the World Cup final with his set pieces. I mean,
decisive bits of play.
We talk about Varane. I mean, you know, Griezmann got a penalty in the first game to win them that game, which was crucial against Australia. Assist for Varane, assist from Titi in the quarterfinals, semifinals. Yep. Set up the own goal, scored the thing. Yeah, he was very important. Very, very. But he's weirdly in complaining and whining.
Well, his campaign was brilliant to do it. Tying kids' shoelaces up. being active in the press. He tried hard to win it,
but ultimately
came third. Ronaldo got second purely again for goals and contribution to that Champions League team. So if this is now the Messi-Ronaldo duopoly is broken, it's almost like anyone can win it again. As we've said, maybe they will use this new definition that we've crafted on the Squawker Talker podcast. So just briefly, in 2019, which is obviously, it's almost silly to forecast what can happen a whole year, where, as we said, there have been so many surprises this year itself. But Messi started pretty hot in this second half of the year.
Yeah.
Do we think it will just return to one of these two next year?
I think that they'll definitely be in contention and be in the top two, top three or four. But, I mean, Modric certainly won't be anywhere near it, that's for sure. No. But you're looking at, I think Neymar, Mbappe, If PSG win the Champions League, then they're going to be two very, very big contenders because they'll be massively influential, and they are players who will target the Ballon d'Or. They'll get goals, yeah. They'll get assists, and they'll be sort of in the mix for, along with Messi and Ronaldo, I would have thought.
If Liverpool win the Champions League and the Nations League, Virgil van Dijk is probably going to make a huge push for it. Not himself, but because he's obviously been so talismanic and important to them. And also, unlike Varane, he's a bit more of a outspoken himself.
He's captain, isn't he?
But he's captain.
Captain, leader, legend.
Yeah, you know, just big, broad-chested, handsome man. But no, I think 2019 is going to see the emergence of the new duopoly in Ballon d'Or winning, and it's Kylian Mbappe versus Ousmane Dembele, mate. That's what we're going to see.
Dembele is an early call.
The two young bucks. The guys doing.
Considering Dembele is still.
Well, yeah, but look at
Messi
look
is still. If whatever Barcelona do, Messi in 2019 is going to be the key part of it. So Dembele can never win.
I'm not being 100% serious, but no. I do think we're going to see the slow, steady creeping of. We're talking about duopolies being
Sancho.
Broken. That those two, Dembele and Mbappe, are the future
England,
world stars.
If England win the inaugural UEFA Nations League, which will
this.
Be the elite competition of 2019. There's no World Cup. It will be the Nations League or bust. And that Final Four is a pretty rogue Final Four. Portugal are in it, so Ronaldo is going to have a shot. But
Harry Maguire.
England, Harry Maguire, Slabhead. Oh, that should have been. In fact, memorable moment, 2018, Harry Maguire being called Slabhead affectionately by everyone in the country. That was one of the best things.
That was pretty good. To be fair, and the memes, Harry Maguire.
So yeah, I don't think he will win it in the Ballon d'Or, Slabhead, in 2019, unfortunately. But one, we've forgotten Salah. If Liverpool do well as well,
he
keeps scoring and they go unbeaten in the Premier League and they win the title and they win
that's
the Champions
true.
League, Mohamed Salah is going to have something to say about it, considering he was so close this year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Virgil van Dijk is a great shout because, again, transformative in Liverpool's progress. Yeah. But yeah, that Nations League could have a big say.
That's part of why I brought up van Dijk. But no, I think if you look at it, it's
and France didn't make it, so Mbappe's ruled out. No, Brazil aren't a UEFA country.
Whoever wins the Champions League is probably going to have a big sway.
That'll be the decider.
To me, you look at it, and it's hard. Obviously, look, there's a whole year to go. But to me, at this stage, it's hard to look past Messi. He's by far and away the best player in the world. There's no World Cup.
We said that doesn't matter.
And no Argentina. Well, yeah, but also Barcelona look like the best team in the Champions League, right? Or certainly the best place to win the Champions League.
So
right
we're
now,
just so. Saying, look out for who's in the final of the Champions League.
Basically,
someone serves up. If someone serves up a performance in that competition, that's probably going to be decided.
Especially if they combine it with
Messi
title.
And Ronaldo are still going to have something to say, aren't they?
So.
It might be the end of their duopoly, but Ronaldo finished second, Messi fifth, which I think, given the backlash, is not going to happen again. So I think we'll see them there. But yeah, Mbappe definitely. Neymar can finally make a shout if they perform well.
They need to win the Champions
League.
They need to win it. They need to win it, those two.
Moving on from the Ballon d'Or into another individual award, which is actually picked by former Messi and Ronaldo would have had a vote in this. Kylian Mbappe won the 2017 Golden Boy. He was nominated for the 2018 award after those World Cup feats, but he didn't win. And in first place, we've said that centre-backs don't get any credit. First place in the Golden Boy in 2018 was Matthijs de Ligt for the Netherlands.
First ever defender to win it, right?
I think I'm pretty sure that's right. And the first Dutch player since Van der Vaart won the inaugural one. So maybe the Golden Boy is marking the change in how our awards are won, because in second place was a right back by the name of Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one that really caught my attention as well. The fact his rise in 2018 has just been sensational, really. And I think that's credit to Klopp and to Southgate as well, and the England setup in general, that they got these young players that have come through the youth system and then they almost ready-made to play at the top level. And that's not happened for quite some time. I think it is good that defenders are being recognised because, you know, like we say, the final award, the Ballon d'Or, maybe should have gone to a defender more times than it has. But I think it's a good award to have. It's maybe a bit more clouded than the Ballon d'Or in terms of who fits in where. Because I suppose Mbappe, maybe people are just thinking he's closer to the main award than he is this one. I don't know how that might work.
Well, he came fourth in the Ballon d'Or.
Yeah,
so
exactly. So
they almost, the thing is, it's they for these awards, Golden Boy especially, they should just say win it once and then you're done. Because we've appreciated your potential. But the fact they nominated him and he didn't win it was, it seems to me, was a bit odd.
It seems weird. Like you said,
I'm always going to say that.
No, but you're right. If you win it, then you shouldn't be... the whole point of it is you're recognising someone as potential. But no, I think De Ligt is a worthy winner, phenomenal player. Again, for the Netherlands, we're talking about Netherlands success, he's been right there next to Van Dijk the whole time.
And again, he's so beyond his age. He's still a teenager.
He's 19. He's not turning 20 until August. That's just... absolutely ridiculous.
Like unbeaten as captain. He's captain of Ajax, who, again, have had their resurgence in the Champions League knockout stages.
He's genuinely, genuinely incredible. When I remember watching him in the 2017 Europa League, and in the final, especially against Man United, you're thinking, he's not 17, shut up. But he is. And it's just...
because he's a mountain as well.
He's a mountain, but it was like the thing with him and Davinson Sanchez is in that game, they're both young, and you could see that Davinson Sanchez was a young centre-back. Like he was a bit... he got brilliant second half, but he's a bit overawed in the first half. But De Ligt, you're like, who is this guy?
Stop living in 2017 as well, by the way. This is a 2018 calendar year review. Back references allowed.
De Ligt is just fantastic. Fully deserved the win for an exceptional year. He's probably going to move in the summer, probably to Barcelona. That's going to be... I think he'll be a hand-in-glove fit there. Replacing PK. I think he's phenomenal. I think he's well deserved. I think he's gonna have a great 2019 as well.
So again, we're saying that maybe Mbappe, if he's nominated, should win it. And I don't think you can even call him a rising star, because 2017 was the year that
he's definitely not propelled himself.
He sort of confirmed his status as one of the best in the world, I would say, this year. But 2017 was when everyone took notice. So De Ligt, Trent Alexander-Arnold, definitely two of 2018's biggest rising stars. But are there any other names that you feel deserve a shout out in that area? Mo or Tom, will let any of you.
Frankie de Jong. Right, you know, another Ajax youngster, phenomenal young. He's actually older than De Ligt, but
21.
Genuinely.
Stop picking old men for this award.
Genuinely, like, an exceptional player, so versatile, so tactically intelligent, can, you know, move up and down the field, can play attacking midfield, centre back.
So basically, just Ajax. I mean, maybe they're not a rising star, but in terms of the awakening of a sleeping giant,
it's beautiful.
Ajax are enjoying a pretty good run.
It's beautiful to see. It really is nice.
Although PSV are actually smashing them in their Eredivisie, which is quite fun.
Well, but I mean, you know,
that league in itself is so fun to watch. And if you want names of exciting young talents, then just go and dial into the Eredivisie, because PSV and Ajax have some serious people that are going to be 50 million plus. 2018 in itself is Jadon Sancho.
I was about to say him as well.
Sorry, you look like you didn't have a name.
No,
so I went
Sancho.
To
Sancho, okay. I think, is the only one that
Let's reset. Tom, who would your rising star of 2018 be?
James Maddison. No, sorry.
Another good shout.
There it is.
Jadon Sancho, I think, in terms of what he's doing in the Bundesliga, and then he's got himself in the England squad. He has to kind of be considered on the same level in terms of a rise as Alexander Arnold, really, because he wasn't in a first team before that, and he's playing really well at the top
and
level.
And I think his story, like, obviously it's the tale of the two, him and Phil Foden, both at Man City. One took the route, Phil Foden obviously being rewarded with a contract, staying at Man City, getting game minutes. Jadon Sancho demanded time earlier, bedded into Dortmund, and in 2018 he's one of the leading assist makers in Europe's top five leagues, especially Englishmen as well. I think only Sterling is ahead of him. So to establish himself as a starter in an unbeaten Bundesliga team, at 18 years old,
scoring,
in a new country.
Scoring big goals as well.
Scoring the winner in their local derby. He's, again, really announced himself this year. And as we spoke about earlier, in terms of the future of English football, it's hard not to get excited, because we've got all these technical players now. Before, we had the steel and the England, the dogged determination. That was all we relied on. Now we're just getting these beautiful footballers being produced almost at a rate that is too fast, considering the amount that are trying to break through. So fitting them all in one team is an exciting but unenviable task for Gareth Southgate.
Good problems to have, man.
Yeah, good problems to have, definitely. But I think the Golden Boy got that nailed on. Obviously, Justin Kluivert was in the running for that. And again, Ajax. He made his big move to Roma and was in the top three. So some teenagers that are definitely going to be making moves in 2019 as well.
Definitely.
But obviously there's going to be completely new names in for that Golden Boy Award. The next thing that we're going to talk about, though, in 2018 is not players themselves, but how they are used. And I wanted to get your opinions on what's the most sort of interesting tactical trend of 2018, whether that be on pitch as a team in a whole or a specific role. Tom, let's go to you first on that one. Anything that you've spotted?
Yeah, one. It's mainly subtle. It has been coming into the game for a little while, but I think it's goalkeepers and the evolution of the goalkeeper. In terms of, I think managers are now looking at it as a necessity to have someone who can sort of play short passes. It's gone up year on year that people are playing short passes from the back, and you've got powerful keepers like Edison and Alisson, who I just think they're sort of the future of the goalkeeper, and that's kind of really come in 2018. And I think that's just the biggest change. It's happened over a period of time, but I think 2018 is where prevalent. They've got players at the top level that are doing it and doing it well, and it's assisting the team scoring goals and assisting the team.
And every team
forward.
Is doing it. Before, you'd be like, oh, if you've got 60% possession, you need a goalkeeper with that can pass it out. But now every team starts with that bizarre goal kick where there's two centre backs split and they just like come and press us.
Yeah, the Guardiola move.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's felt like it's a necessity for a lot of managers now rather than like an added bonus. So I think that's a big change.
Yeah, I mean, you look at it, compare it to, let's say, 4 years ago when it was just Neuer and Ter Stegen playing like that, basically, and Valdez when he was fit. And then now it's like every goalkeeper.
Well, Neuer was seen as sort of this mad
lunatic
that was standing on the halfway line. But now goalkeepers are picking up. One thing I'd add into that is the emphasis on distribution itself. Yeah. And you see these like side-widening kicks being practiced, as you said, as a weapon to launch counter-attacks and to get assists. Jordan Pickford is brilliant in his kicking, and I love seeing him release it that fast. And England haven't had that in a goalkeeper for a while. And you see the likes of Edison with the Guinness World Record he got this year of the longest kick. But there's a subtlety and there's a technique to goalkeeping now. That is more attention is being given to it, but also, as you said, Thomas, in 2018 it's now widespread. Teams in the Championship are relying on their goalkeepers to play in football, where before that would be sort of frowned upon or seems unnecessary.
Yeah, it's very much been all predicated on Guardiola and the way he's sort of expanded the Barcelona philosophy. Because you look at Ter Stegen is probably still the outstanding example of a passing goalkeeper, but you look at it, he used to be an outlier, completely an outlier, and now it's like he's just one of many. I mean, and obviously Guardiola, everyone made a big fuss about him replacing Joe Hart with Claudio Bravo, but there was very much method behind his madness. Yeah. It was like, I need someone who can pass out from the back. And okay, City weren't...
Well, Bravo could pass out from the back, but he couldn't use his hands.
Yeah, but then if you look at it, what Bravo did was, by being able to pass out the back, was to allow City's defenders to understand and get used to the idea of playing out of the back. So when he replaced Bravo with Edison, who could actually pass out and save shots, it was like, oh, City...
The dream.
Yeah, well, exactly. City then suddenly became... Well, they won the league title. They won the 100 points. So it's, Tom. That's a really good trend, I think, from Thomas, the passing out from the back goalkeepers now.
Yeah, just the, I think it's the, we're not trying to say, oh, this is the first year someone's passing out from the back.
Not.
We're just saying.
It is now a trend rather than an isolated thing.
Yeah, that's what I've been trying to say. Like, because
everyone does.
Before it was just a handful of goalies.
If your goalie doesn't pass out the back, who do you think you even are?
Exactly. I mean, you know what? Atletico Madrid, Atletico Madrid are basically the only team. If you look at the best goalkeepers in the world right now, Ter Stegen, Kepa,
De Gea, Edison.
Alisson, Edison. Yeah. You look, De Gea and Oblak are the only two sort of throwbacks where you'd say that passing out the back is not their strong point. Mm. Like every other goalkeeper, the best goalies in the world.
Distribution is great.
Distribution is brilliant. Those two, not so much, but that's okay. They don't play in those kind of sides.
Are you leaning on goalkeepers or have you got
No. My tactical trend is what we're seeing, it's sort of more Guardiola influence, but it's the use of attacking midfielders, wingers becoming central midfielders. The idea of the emphasis on possession in midfield is now just so thorough in football that we're now seeing players who were once wingers, like actual just out and out wingers, becoming central midfielders and performing well there. You know, Kevin De Bruyne, obviously David Silva and Bernardo Silva, the key examples at Man City, but you're looking at Jesse Lingard is doing it for England. You look at James Rodriguez has been doing it for Bayern Munich.
Not under Kovac,
but you know, and Coutinho is doing it for Brazil. Like there was a big thing about Coutinho coming midfield for us at the World Cup, and everyone's sort of like, "What are you talking about?" And he put Coutinho midfield for the whole World Cup, and he was good there. So it's this sort of emphasis on playing through midfield with technique, with technical players, and with ball movement and with off the ball movement as well, more so than with just what we call traditionally rugged, robust midfielders, a big, strong guys, someone who can take care of themselves physically. It's trusting in the technique of midfielders, which is something that again before you would just see Xavi and Iniesta do it, and maybe a couple of other teams, like you'd have Jorginho at Napoli, and you'd have like the Swansea guys, you know, Joe Allen and Leon Britton as well before. But there was a handful of teams that played that way. Now it's loads of teams play that way. All the top sides play that way. You know, even Liverpool, before he sold Coutinho, he was playing Coutinho in central midfield. You know,
so yeah, trying to work him in there.
Yeah, and he's played Shaqiri there at times this season, Jurgen Klopp. So, you know, it's all about that.
I think Liverpool are a good reference point for as well, for sort of the rise of the wing forward. How a high percentage of teams' goals now, especially the ones that play 4-3-3, don't come from their centre forward.
Yeah.
It comes from the people either side of them. And that happened with France, obviously, in the World Cup. Their centre forward did not have a shot on target. It was every player around him. I know Griezmann had a role sort of in behind that, but Mbappe was their out and out striker.
Yeah.
And now you've got this idea that to be a goal scorer now, you're a winger, you're a wide forward. You don't get a winger. Leroy Sané is probably the only example of a Premier League elite winger for an elite side, in the sense that he's still racking up assists from those crosses. No one else really does that.
Theo Walcott was born 10 years too early.
Exactly, yes. He would have loved that role in PSG's right wing.
Oh, yeah.
Getting served up by Neymar. But I think what goes in partner with that is the fact that every kid now is going to be dreaming of becoming a fullback. Because everyone gets attention. We've said it. Trent Alexander-Arnold, golden boy, or second on that list. You've got Benjamin Mendy, again, when... So he doesn't play with Sané because he becomes the left winger. In 2018, fullbacks have been given the complete freedom because of the wing forwards cutting inside and being reliant on scoring goals. You have your centre midfielders that they're technical ones, and fullbacks now are just given complete freedom, especially with the growth of use of wingbacks in back threes, or the return, I should say.
Yeah.
Now everyone wants to be like the fun Benjamin Mendy. Andy Robertson is one of Liverpool's favourite players.
Jordi Alba.
Jordi Alba is Lionel Messi's partner in crime, almost. The amount of assists they serve up for each other.
Real Madrid's Champions League dominance, although often ignored, was heavily built on Carvajal and Marcelo.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Marcelo is probably one of the most gifted footballers in the world, and he plays at left back. Arsenal use Hector Bellerin as their main attacking outlet on the right. The fullback this year has become attack first, defend second. It's about your holding midfielders plugging those gaps. That's what Man City had to work out. Delph becoming that inverted fullback. But I just love the fact that in 2018, you've got it's almost the wide players are your main outlets in terms of direct contribution to goals.
Yeah.
All the work's done in midfield by these creative players that have moved into that position. Now, the person scoring your goals is the right winger, and the person setting them up is the left fullback.
It's great fun. If you look at these three trends we've covered, right, the one thing, the unifying factor in all of them is proactive, being proactive, playing quote unquote good football, attacking technical football. We have entered the age of Guardiola. We were in it, we've been in it since 2009, but now we're fully into it now, because now all the people that have taken on his methods and done their own little spin on them, or taken them in their own different ways, it's all bearing fruit now, because now literally every single, with the exception of Diego Simeone, with the exception of Simeone and Jose Mourinho, every single top coach in the world, although with Mourinho is still a top coach, whatever, but every single top coach in the world is now following this Guardiola blueprint of playing with the ball, possession, technical football. And we're living in that age now. The three trends that each of us have spotted out all came from that one thing, technical football and playing with the ball. And it's resulted in younger players getting a chance, technical players getting a chance, and more beautiful football being played. And now also, it makes the sides like Atletico Madrid and Mourinho's Man United, if he ever goes out together, much more refreshing, and Juventus, because they're in their dogged defensive attitude. Now they're an outlier. It makes them more, you can appreciate them a bit more. Whereas instead of defensive drudgery just being the
norm.
It's
sort of like if these progressive sides have sort of toppled that regime again, there's this few outliers that are still clinging onto it, but sort of the true representations of it have survived.
Yeah, and it's also easier to root for someone just playing blind defensive football if they're underdogs, because it's like, it's hard to watch that and be like, yeah, this is good. You're like, God.
Burnley, for example, using it to get into the Europa League.
Yeah, if you're rooting for someone as an underdog, it's actually easier to appreciate non-technical football. So I feel like the overall trend, if there is one, is technical play, basically.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think we've covered some great points about this year in football. Trying to cover a year in one podcast is almost a ridiculous attempt in itself. But the one final thing, I think, obviously, Gawker Talker podcast, thank you to everyone that listens. So I think it's best if we end on a listener's question for the 2018 roundup. And it is one of our most loyal listeners in Mr. Walker Porter, saying
big
that
man.
Who is your hero and villain of 2018?
Hero, I'm going to... Oh, it's not Tyler earlier, but it's Gareth Southgate for me. I really do think... It just the way he...
Thomas Rooney.
I can't look beyond England the World Cup, to be honest. I just think of the way he's... I mean, he won Coach of the Year at Sports Personality.
Yeah.
And I just think the way he galvanised the whole squad and the things he's doing for English football, even before that, and sort of in the younger groups. He's my hero. For the villain...
Oh, stop it there.
For my villain... I didn't want to say Mourinho, but then I've ended up saying Mourinho. But then I think he quite enjoys being it anyway.
Oh, he loves it.
So
Liverpool fans would argue that Ramos.
True.
Is the villain.
Yeah, that's a very good another shout. But yeah, it was definitely
ending Mohamed Salah's Champions League final.
My son has now decided that the best insult he can give me is to say that you're Sergio Ramos. Cool. So I think
that sums it up quite nicely.
Yeah.
Mo, do you have anyone different for the hero? Or
hero,
villain?
I mean, just go fall off the tactical trend. Guardiola is the hero. I think just falling off the tactical trend, the thing we're living in his era of football now, he's shaped this current era of football more than anyone else, I think. And he's slightly played beautiful football. And, you know, he's just a lovely man. So what are you going to say? And villain, Florentino Perez for derailing and destroying Spain's World Cup title hope, which probably would have ended in victory. By signing Lopetegui in a really disrespectful manner, like not communicating it with the staff, not communicating with the FA, and announcing it via press conference without even telling anybody. Like, that's just so disrespectful. And then also sacking Jose Lopetegui like 2 months into the Real Madrid, when it was clear that whether or not we don't know, obviously we weren't behind the scenes, but it's clear that what Lopetegui's strengths are, which is coaching young players and bringing the young players through, he wasn't allowed to or wasn't encouraged to do because he didn't do it. Like, Madrid have got loads of good young players. You're now seeing that with Santi Solari. So why wasn't Lopetegui doing that? Mm. Why wasn't he? It's almost like with Rafa Benitez. When Rafa Benitez took charge, Casemiro was there. They wanted to play Casemiro, and he wasn't allowed to. He had to play Modric and Kroos. Mm. And then Zidane came in, and Zidane was allowed to play Casemiro. And
I think one of the heroes you could say is Zidane for 2018 because
win the Champions League and
third
leave.
Third Champions League in a row, and then just leave in a complete fanfare, and then see Real Madrid sort of collapse almost.
He judged that very well.
Yeah, so a heroic judgment of the scenario. But I think maybe Perez as the villain is quite strong and a bit. It's a bit tongue in cheek, but in terms of it's neither hero or villain, but Julian Lopetegui, you have to feel sorry. If there are people like Salah and Modric who have had 2018s to remember and have been brilliant, then Lopetegui he can't wait for New Year, because he'd won 20 games unbeaten as Spain manager, scored in every single game. They looked like they were going to be one of the contenders for the World Cup. Gets a once in a lifetime opportunity to manage at Real Madrid. Wasn't done in the greatest way, which ruined his reputation.
Yeah.
And then not only did that stop him from leading that Spain side that he'd built in his image into the World Cup, he then gets to Real Madrid and it all falls to pieces. Yes. And
well, I mean, yeah, that's the reason why I mentioned Perez, is because Perez obviously ruined Spain's World Cup by bringing Lopetegui, but then didn't get Lopetegui the striker he needed.
And then ruined Real Madrid.
Sold Ronaldo.
So
it's just, I feel bad.
So Perez, you need to be sending some nice Christmas cards to Lopetegui to make up for it.
Send him a bottle of wine or something. Jeez, I mean,
but that does it for our roundup of 2018. And in the second half of this podcast, we're going to be joined by a special guest, as I said. But this is the moment where, unfortunately, Mohamed and Tom leave us. Oh. So I'd just like to say thank you for all the podcasts this year, everything you've done, all the hot takes, all the slander and the praise in equal measure, I think.
Well, I mean, and I'll go out as my highlight of 2018, which was saying my catchphrase, which is, World Cup!
Which is good for 2018. I think it suits. And Thomas, thank you very much.
Hosting
through half of it. In fact, the biggest tactical change in 2018 has been from Thomas Rooney becoming an excellent guest.
Exactly.
On the podcast.
Do some research and not just ask some questions. It's amazing.
So thank you for joining us. And I'm sure there'll be many more in the new year. So let's move on to the second half. Now, for those of you that have made it to the second part of the Squawker Talker Festive Special, or indeed you're so excited that you've skipped ahead, it's time to introduce that very special guest I promised. With nearly 500 games at club level over a 20-year career, including a couple of goals, 41 caps for England, it's my absolute pleasure to welcome FansBet ambassador Paul Robinson onto the podcast. Paul, how are you?
Very well, thank you yourself. Thank you for having me, firstly.
No, it's absolute pleasure, as I said. I've got plenty of questions about your career and your take on the current goalkeepers. But first,
I think we have to start with the Star Sixes tournament coming to Glasgow in January. England are putting a strong team together. Are they your early favourites for that?
Looking at the names that they've got, I think it's going to be a fantastic tournament. I think it's going to be the best one they've ever had, to be fair. You look down the list of the names, you know, the likes of Pires, Michael Owen, you know, just to name a few, Ryan Giggs especially. I think it's the strongest lineup that the Star Sixes have had, and I think it's going to be a really exciting tournament this year.
And as well, they're hosting it in Glasgow, which is obviously known for pretty intense atmospheres in the football. Can we expect the same for the Star Sixes? And do you have any experience of Glasgow atmosphere in your playing days as well?
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that the fans will get involved because, as I've said, the amount of players, the ex-players, the level of ex-players that are turning up should be great entertainment for the fans. I played myself a couple of times Celtic Park and Ibrox in pre-season friendlies, as well as Aberdeen and Hearts as well, but never competitive games. But the pre-season friendlies up there have always been sold out, and they've always been great occasions.
I was going to say, even for pre-season, sorry, that I can imagine they turn out pretty well for those.
Yeah, very much so, especially with the Leeds and Tottenham connection to Celtic. So the two sets of supporters, you know, it was sold out. It was great atmosphere. And obviously been to watch a few games in Tottenham as well and experienced Scotland as well and experienced the atmosphere. And it's second to none. And if anything, you know, if half of that can be recreated for this Soccer Sixes, it'll be brilliant.
Yeah, it's definitely a tournament to look forward to. And just going sort of focusing more on England, who have somehow decided to pick David James ahead of yourself in goal. Is there a technical reason for that? In six aside, do goalkeepers have to have certain traits to excel at this level?
Probably has got a lot better back than I have, because my back is not very good, and that's what finished my career. So that's probably why he's playing. But no, England have got a very strong team, and JMO is very fit for his age. But in small-sided games, you play a lot of small-sided games in training. So it's nothing new to the players. It's something that they'll be used to. And as a goalkeeper, it's just about keeping a low centre of gravity, really.
And then Darren Bent is the sort of the latest signing, obviously at the other end of the pitch, a former teammate of yours as well. Do you think he's going to be finished top scorer in the tournament?
He's got a lot of competition. I'm sure Michael Owen alone in the England side will have something to say about that. But Benty's main quality was his pace. I'm not so sure I was going to exploit that in the, you know, in the small arena of a six-a-side pitch.
Yeah, that's the thing with once the pitch shrinks, the quick players get exposed, don't they, a bit about only having one strength in sort of a jokey way. But it all becomes about technique and sort of that futsal style that maybe England development-wise is something that we've started focusing on now with the younger generation coming through as well.
Yeah, it's a lot more about football and keeping the ball and possession and passing. There's not so many balls going to be played over the top for Benty to run onto, as you say. But he has got all-round football and ability, as have a lot of the players there. And I think you'll see a lot of the training sessions nowadays at professional football clubs. Players will go out, they'll have a circle, they'll play keep ball, and there's a lot of possession games in training. Yes, when you go into the 11-a-side pitch, you don't necessarily see it as much in such small-sided games. But I think this gives you the chance to see the actual quality that players possess.
I think as well, from watching sort of the old five-a-side tournaments that used to use the legends as well, I think everyone starts to realise that these professional footballers are pretty good. Because as you say, you see them in a different light. It's not a big, large pitch where sort of the athleticism plays a massive part. This is all technique. And with the likes of JJ Okocha and, as you mentioned, Robert Pires, we can expect to see some real displays of skill that you might have forgotten that some players didn't have in their locker as well, a chance to show off, if you will.
And you don't actually realise the ability that some of the players have got. You know, there's a lot of players that are famed for their defending, for their tenacity in midfield, etc., etc. But these players can play football, and you know, I've seen it every day on a training ground, and you see the small-sided games and the possession games. And the quality that players possess will come out more in a small-sided game. And because, yes, there's going to be a huge competitive edge on it, but because it's slightly more relaxed than, say, a Premier League game, players will try things. You'll get to see players trying different skills, different tactics, different techniques. Some will come off, some that won't come off. But it'll be more like a training ground game where players will actually try things.
I think that was sort of the case with Salgado scoring quite a few goals in last year's tournament. Obviously, a marauding right-back in his day, known for that engine, but became a prolific scorer in a small-sided game. And just on that point there, you said about sort of players not being known for their skills. Is there anyone that you know that's playing in the tournament that's coming up, or even someone that you played with in your playing days that perhaps never got the credit for being sort of a technical wizard and someone that would excel in a six-sided tournament?
You talk about Michelle there. I played with Michelle at Blackburn, and he's the angriest, most competitive little man in my life. That's why he scored goals. He will set out in that tournament to win without a shadow of a doubt. He wants to win no matter what he does in training. I think David Dunn's a recent addition to the England side as well. And his quality that I saw at Blackburn on the training ground as well, not necessarily known for his goal scoring ability, but his eye for a pass and the small sided game will suit him. So if he gets some game time, it'll be interesting to see what Dunny can do.
Yeah, plenty of players to look forward to. Beyond England, you mentioned that England have got such a strong team. Is there any other team that you're sort of scared of that might be able to give England a run for their money? Or basically, I'm going to ask you for a bold prediction on already who's going to win the Star Sixes tournament in when come January.
Well, looking at the teams, England are going to win. The strength they've got. And I'm an Englishman, so you'd never back against your own country. But as I've said, there is a strong lineup everywhere else you look. The rest of the world are very strong with Pires, Alberts, Ronald de Boer, Van Hooijdonk, Mendieta especially, Okocha, Petrov. If they can gel as a team, they'll be a real threat because there's a lot of ability in the rest of the world team.
Yeah, that is a pretty stacked list of names.
That could be like a circuit. They could just be trying different tricks, but if they can gel as a team, that'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, of course. Okocha, I think, will be definitely a fan favourite if he manages to pull that rainbow flick out that it... If he managed to do that in Premier League games, you can only imagine that he's going to whip a few out in this six-a-side format.
Sure.
So obviously you're not involved, and as you said, perhaps your back's a reason for that. But I also wanted to ask if you had the chance to sort of enter your own six-a-side team, whether you'd be in goal or not. Do you happen to have a sort of names that you'd probably call upon to join you in the Star Sixes tournament?
What, anything? Can I call on anyone that I've played with?
Yeah, you can call on anyone form. Maybe people that you've played with before to keep it within your sort of area. But yeah, a former teammate, Star Sixes. Who would Paul Robinson's team be?
I would definitely go and goal. I'd have to go and goal if it's my team.
Yeah,
I'd take a few painkillers for me back and get through it. Centre halves. Probably you need ball playing centre halves that can defend as well. So probably Ledley King. Hugely underrated. Spurs fans know that his capabilities, his defensive capabilities, but also ball playing centre-half. With him, Rio Ferdinand. I'd have Ledley and Rio at the back, two players who can defend but can also play. Midfield, a bit of tenacity and some ball playing ability. I'd probably go with Steven Gerrard due to the fact he can play in any position, and Paul Scholes because he can play off the front as well. And then up front, I don't know, there's a few that I could pick up front, but probably as a five-a-side player, maybe Robbie Keane. It'd be close between Robbie Keane and Wayne Rooney. So I'd probably go Ledley King and Rio at the back, Gerrard and Scholes midfield behind Robbie Keane. There you go.
I think that would cause some damage. As you said, Ledley King is sort of another player who, again, from watching him myself, every time he played looked like an absolute colossus and as you said, class on and off the ball. And it was that one injury that sort of maybe robbed everyone of one of the Premier League's sort of best ever centre backs, if he wasn't considered one of those already. I think
he can be put in that bracket, especially with the Spurs fans. You ask any Spurs fans about Ledley King and they'll tell you how good he actually was, and he finished young because of his knees, and I obviously spent a lot of time with him, played with him, and you see the amount of training that he didn't do and that he wasn't able to take part in. Yeah, he could still come on the pitch on a Saturday and perform at the level that he did. If he was able to train on a weekly basis regularly at the intensity of the rest of the squad, you know, you don't know what he could have achieved because of what he actually did achieve with the limited ability to train that he had.
Yeah, so that's always a story that had been reported, but I just wanted to sort of confirm then. Was there weeks where he was solely just turning up on match day and being put in the starting 11 and not really training at all, or was it just sort of really light compared to what everyone else used to do?
A couple of days after a game, Ledley would be looked after. There's nothing ridiculously different to what everyone else would do. Do light versions of you. Players are managed these days. It's not just about putting a whole team on the training pitch every day. It's about managing individuals and managing the individual's needs. There's different ages and different characters in the squad, if you like. Certain players a day after a game could train. Certain players 2 days after a game would get stiff. I mean, there's a lot of players that get stiff 2 days after a game. So there's some managers that would do a warm down or a little bit of training the day after a game and give you the second day off. But Ledley, as such, he had to be managed on his own. He had his own program, his own routine, if you like. And it was a case of what worked for him. But no, he would never just turn up and play. If he hadn't trained on the Thursday or Friday before the game, he wouldn't play.
Okay, so it was still, he was still doing something, but it was just that that knee injury sort of made him...
He's clever.
Sort of Spurs had to develop their own schedule to get the best out of him, as you said.
And he had to develop his own schedule as well with the people at Spurs.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And as you said, that Star Sixes team that you'd put together itself, I think that would... I think that would push England, even the England representatives, for a tournament win. So just to remind everyone, the Star Sixes obviously is in January, the 4th to the 6th at Glasgow's SSE Hydro. You can watch England play. Obviously, there's rest of the world. The England team, David James, Michael Owen, Emil Heskey, a Liverpool strike duo, are being reunited there. And obviously Fansbet are sponsoring this event, and I wanted to ask you as well, because obviously being a Fansbet ambassador, I just wanted to ask you about your role with them, and also just, I've heard that you put together an accumulator every weekend, and being obviously a stats website, Squawker, I wondered how much you sort of lent on stats and data, or do you very much base it on your own experiences of the game and do it fixture by fixture?
I don't really know how to answer that at the moment because my accumulators haven't been great of late. Picks haven't been coming off. I generally try and pick a couple of bankers with one in there. I do a treble every week. So I do two that I think are your one or two that you nailed on, and then one that will boost the odds for your accumulator. So it's actually worth having a little bet on. So now I look at recent results, runs of form. I backed Crystal Palace twice the last 2 weeks because I thought their bad run of form had to end.
Yeah.
There, but the results were going, it wasn't relevant to their performances. So I thought their run of form had to end, but I think that'll be short-lived because they're away at City this weekend.
Yeah.
It's something that I do look at a few stats, but I do look at recent form, injuries, personnel, and the way that teams are playing.
Yeah, it's obviously you don't just want to rely solely on the data as well, and having played the game as well, I bet you have a better understanding of. Yeah, you can sort of tell how certain players are feeling or leading up to each game or how the managers are reacting. And you mentioned Man City there, and I think it's a good time to ask you a bit about the current football as well. Obviously, as I mentioned, your career, 20 years, and apologies if I've got any of that wrong at the beginning. I'm sure you'll correct me if so. But one thing that I found really interesting is that so making your debut as a teenager goalkeeper is something that we don't really see at all now. Jordan Pickford is probably the youngest number one in the Premier League, and he's 24 years old. And I know he was a bit younger when he came through at Sunderland, but still not a teenager. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on sort of how the goalkeeper role has evolved, mainly looking through the Premier League lens, and why... if anything, that has to do with why young keepers are maybe finding it more difficult to break through as you did.
I was fortunate. I was third choice goalkeeper at the time. Nigel Martin got injured, and the second choice goalkeeper, Mark Beaney, was going to play at the weekend. And I think it was a Wednesday or a Thursday, he unfortunately, for him, ruptured his Achilles tendon. And the manager didn't have any choice other than to play me at the weekend. And that's how I was given my chance. So I was very, very fortunate. Yes, I had to take my chance. Yes, I had to play well. But as I say, I was third in line and very, very fortunate to be able to give them the chance at the time. Very grateful for it. But yeah, it was fortune rather than ability, but I was there ready to take it. I don't think the age of goalkeepers necessarily matters, as we said about Jordan Pickford. The main reason, in my opinion, that goalkeepers aren't given their chance early on is the same reason as a lot of young players are not given the chance early on, is because the managers are under such great pressure at the moment. A manager hasn't got 3 or 4 months to blood a young goalkeeper in a team where he needs results, as we've seen only today with Jose Mourinho.
I was going to say that is the perfect opportunity to obviously mention the Jose Mourinho sacking. And it's interesting, as you said, sort of almost humble saying that luck played a massive part in being involved so early. I'm guessing the talent would have proven eventually, given how long your career and successful it was. But with that Mourinho, obviously sacking, could you see that coming? Was that something that when you were looking ahead to fixtures, were you avoiding sort of putting Man United on the list because of the apparent volatility at the club?
There's been a lot of unrest there for a long, long time. I think when the owner and the manager fall out, there's only ever going to be one winner. The owner of the football club wins every time. Manchester United haven't been Manchester United for a long time recently. There's been noises coming out of the club, unrest between manager and different players. And it's not the Manchester United of old that we've come to know. And as I was saying before, it's a results game. And if results don't go, especially against your biggest rivals, Liverpool, then there's going to be a problem. Managers now have such a short lifespan, which, back to my point about the goalkeepers, they can't risk blood in young goalkeepers. If a board is going to give a manager money to spend, say for instance, Manchester City need a left back, is Pep Guardiola going to blood a youngster who's in the academy, who's been out on loan for a couple of times, which will probably take him 3 or 4 months to blood him into the team, or is he going to spend 50 million on a new one because the board will give him it? And unfortunately, for young players, that's the world that we're living in. Teams like Manchester City and Chelsea have squads that they will do a pre-season with and then send them out on loan. And they have coaches and managers to monitor their loan squads. But Manchester United, the problems that they've got there are well documented. And yes, could I see that coming? Yes, I could see it coming. Because once a manager and a board fall out, the owner of a football club gets what he wants.
Yeah, and it's you mentioned there about obviously Man City being able to spend 50 million on left back, and that's exactly what they did during that season with Mendy coming in and then Walker on the other side. And perhaps that was why Mourinho was a bit angry, considering that he wasn't given that same backing to get the exact players he wanted with obviously no centre-backs coming in.
But about his chase for centre-backs this year, and I think that was, you know, that was the beginning of the end, if you like. And as you say, Manchester City spent what they spent, and Pep did the same with the goalkeeper. He came in and initially said, don't fancy Joe Hart, don't want him. Bought Bravo, thought, do you know what, I've got that wrong. I'll spend another few million quid and got another one, got Edison.
Yeah, so, and Liverpool have mirrored that as well with Alisson coming in. Obviously, who actually made a mistake at the weekend, and in terms of stats, he's actually up there with errors leading to shots, which is almost surprising. But the difference he's made to that Liverpool team is obvious. They're sitting at the top of the table. And this is sort of, this relates to the Man United stuff as well. I just wanted to get your opinion on whether Alisson is now the best goalkeeper in the Premier League, and also how much the centre-back pairing in front of you has an impact on what people then perceive you as a goalkeeper. Because David De Gea, for example, I know it was a similar Manchester United team, but last season he almost had a superhuman campaign, winning the Golden Glove and making ridiculous saves. This season, he seems to just be a good goalkeeper still, but obviously a few more goals going in. So there's sort of two questions there. One, is Alisson the best in the Premier League? If not, who do you think is up there in sort of a top three? And also, how much did you rely on your centre-backs when you were in goal to sort of form a trident that was hard to beat?
In my opinion, De Gea is the best in the Premier League. Alisson's come in. He's done okay so far. I'm going to reserve judgment on him. The two things that I worry about Alisson was Wojciech Szczesny kept him out of the team for a year at Roma, which I don't think is anything to you know, to shout about. He only played 37 games for Roma. He's still very young. Yes, he's a top-class goalkeeper. Yes, he's still got to prove himself at this level. Is he better than the two they had? Without a doubt, he's better than the two they had. They needed a top-class goalkeeper. They had two decent goalkeepers, Liverpool, that were struggling with confidence. They needed a top-class goalkeeper, and they got a top-class goalkeeper. And he needs to live up to that now. He needs to perform week in and week out and earn them points, as De Gea does for Manchester United. The important signing that Liverpool made was Van Dijk. He has completely transformed their fortunes defensively. He's brought Joe Gomez on to another level. He's improved as a player no end. The two fullbacks as well. Liverpool going forward were never in question, but what Van Dijk has done for that back four is vitally important. De Gea is the best in the world for me at the moment, and he has, because he's been so consistent for such a long time at Manchester United. He produced the save of the season, if not even longer than that, against Young Boys this season at Old Trafford. I don't know if you've seen it, there's a shot from the edge of the box. It goes through a crowd of players. gets two deflections and he doesn't react till the ball's over the 6 yard line, and then he dives backwards and pulls it out of his goal.
Unreal. I think De Gea probably has his own top 10 of saves himself. He does seem to have that knack of just, because for me as well, sort of an onlooker, he doesn't have the typical frame of a goal, or he's quite slim, quite slender, so he's not that necessarily commanding, but then he makes up for that in what seems to be an ability to contort his body to any area of the goal to make the saves.
There was a lot of criticism of him his first season. I think we forget the criticism that he came under when he came into this country. Eric Steele, the goalkeeper coach at the time, stood by him, did a lot in the press, said, you know, give this lad time, he's going to be one of the best, if not the best in the world. And he's been proven right. He had a tough first year, but it's tough coming into the Premier League. It's a different league to any other league. There's high balls, the pace of the game. There's different things, different elements involved. And De Gea had, it took him 12 months to adjust to this league. And he's certainly adjusted now. Yes, he's smaller than an average goalkeeper, if you like. He's slighter, but his distribution, his shot stopping, he comes off his line. He doesn't come off his line for every cross, every ball. He doesn't look big and commanding. But when he does, he picks his way through and he gets the ball. And, you know, for me, he's consistently been the best.
Yeah, I think it's hard to argue. If you look at his record, even in that first season, it wasn't a bad record. It was just those some high-profile errors. Always making plenty of saves, which is maybe not necessarily a good thing for a top team like Man United having to rely on him that much. But as you said, single-handedly or footedly or double-handedly is sometimes the case, winning them points. So if he's the best in the world, as you've said, goalkeeper-wise in the Premier League, I wanted to get your opinion on one, what happens at Burnley with goalkeepers, because it seems that everyone that goes there is always in line for an England recall or propelled into the spotlight. So I wanted to know if there was anything special that Burnley are doing with their goalkeepers that maybe you experienced whilst you were there, that helps them develop so quickly. And also if there are any other goalkeepers in the Premier League that you feel are underrated or going to challenge De Gea eventually for the best in the league.
Burnley's a football club that I thoroughly enjoyed my time at. And Sean creates an environment in which players enjoy training, enjoy going in every day. And it gives you an opportunity to be your best. The goalkeeper coach there, Billy Mercer, is very much of the same opinion. And they create an environment, an enjoyable, hard-working, very hard-working environment for you to flourish. And that's always been the case there with Billy. I thoroughly loved my time there, enjoyed the end of my career there. And as you say, they've got three top class goalkeepers there with Tom Heaton, Nick Pope, and now Joe Hart. Tom and Nick have been very, very unlucky with their injuries at the time they sustained them. And I think, you know, Joe's conceded a lot of goals recently, but we've also seen his form turn. I think he's been in outstanding form. Down to that environment to feel comfortable and been given the confidence to play your game. It's just a very, very good football club to be a part of.
Yeah, Joe Hart, I think, tops the league for saves made. And as you said, despite conceding a lot, he's asked to do a lot. And again, himself has made some brilliant saves this season. It's just sometimes the case of Burnley maybe struggling a bit compared to last year, which means the couple of little deflections aren't going the way or teams finding that one extra shot to beat them. So yeah, just on the last question, I think Tom Heaton and Nick Pope, when they're fit, sort of fall into the category. But is there another goalkeeper that you've maybe got your eyes on, whether it's in the Premier League, in the Championship, any other league at all, that you would sort of be tipping for maybe?
What about the French League?
What was that, sorry?
French League, what about Ligue 1? Am I allowed to give you one from Ligue 1 in France? Yeah,
that would be brilliant if you could.
The boy Areola. There's a boy called Areola at PSG. Given his chance a couple of times last year. He's been kind of sharing the gloves this year with Buffon. Played for France in the Nations League against Germany. Well, one of the first games in the Nations League this year, kept a clean sheet. And I think he's got all-round ability. I think he's going to be, really is going to be one to watch. I'm disappointed in a way that PSG got Buffon this year too, because it's going to hamper Areola's progress. But he's stayed there. He's still getting the odd game. I think they see him as the long-term answer to their goalkeeping solution. If you like, I don't think they've got a goalkeeping problem, but the long-term... Yeah. Goalkeeping situation. He's commanding, he's very, very young. in a similar ilk to the way Donnarumma is at AC Milan. I mean, you can't look over Donnarumma. I mean, he played for AC Milan when he was 16, made his international debut at 17. And I think the age he is now, he's played over 100 games for AC Milan and he's not hit his 20th birthday.
Yeah, he played, in recent weeks, it was confirmed that it was his 100th consecutive 90 minutes that he was played. And as you said about getting the chance in your career early, I think he's been given more of a chance than anyone has ever had, as you said, at making it at 16.
And it's only recently he's just started coming under a little bit of criticism. The Milan fans have, you know, started questioning a few things about him. So it'll be interesting to see how he comes through this time. But I think we can use Buffon as an example, if you like. He's now at PSG with Areola behind him. And Donnarumma is the next Buffon at international level. He could be the Italian goalkeeper for the next however many years and emulate everything that Buffon has done. But unfortunately, he hasn't got the team that Buffon had playing in front of him because the Italian team... they're not great at the moment.
So Buffon's almost the gatekeeper for two goalkeepers with a lot of sort of untapped potential to get their chance on the scene. If when he retires, which we don't know when that will be, then Areola can make that claim and show his ability that you've sort of forecasted there. And obviously...
Well, he's not got a bad mentor. If Buffon's mentored Donnarumma and he's retired from international football and he's taken over from him there, when Buffon retires, I think Areola is the natural successor.
That's great. And again, it's great to have the Ligue 1 as well, because that's a league that sometimes people have a strange perception of, but Lyon proved in the Champions League that they are talented, and PSG, obviously, that Areola's team have an incredible squad. So, yeah, it's good to get perspective on the fact that they're producing talent there as well. I think that is all we've got time for, which is unfortunate, because I have plenty more questions that I would like to ask, but... it's great to get your thoughts on that Star Sixes tournament, which is, as you said, going to be really fun, and Glasgow is the perfect place for it, really. We're hoping England can bring football home in that respect as well, even if it is six aside. So I just want to say a massive thanks for all your thoughts on the tournament itself and also the current goalkeeping climate.
No worries. Thank you for having me. And keep them questions for another time, maybe.
Yeah, definitely. That would be great. And to Squawker Talker listeners, thank you very much for joining us on the festive special. We'll see you in 2019. Thank you.